Right now, it's Thursday morning. It's a little bit after 8 o'clock. Our regularly scheduled program is a live call-in show. Perhaps you've tuned in specifically for that, for our KUNM call-in show. It's a public affairs show. We feature interviews with the newsmakers of the day, with common folks who are experiencing the impacts of policies and decisions, and lawmakers and advocates. We try to bring a wide range of perspectives to conversations about the most important issues that our communities are facing. This first clip from a KUNM call-in show that we're going to hear is from a show called Supporting Teen Parents. Host Sarah Gustavus spoke with Johnny Wilson from Fathers of New Mexico and Denicia Cadena from Young Women United.
We've had a high teen pregnancy rate for a long time. Do you think there's a different approach now in saying let's work with these young people, let's provide them the services that the people are talking about today?
Yes, absolutely. I think there is. And I think, you know, you having a call-in show like this is demonstrates that.
Certainly,
I think
helpful.
We've got a long way to go because, let's face it, we are one of the highest states of teen pregnancy, and the U.S. is one of the has the highest teen pregnancy rate. So really, we're kind of New Mexico is ground zero for this issue. So we can do a lot to lead the rest of the country, but it's really down to each individual having the conversation, keeping the conversation alive, and understanding that these teens want to do the best job. They just don't know necessarily how to because they haven't had the mentoring or they haven't had a great way to see how they can progress. So I think places like Grads, New Vistas, and many, many other places. But it's all about connecting and giving those all of those wraparound services so that we can actually change the next generation.
If I can interject here, remember that 50% of pregnancies in the United States of all age groups are unplanned. Okay, which, by the way, is one of the worst statistics in the developed world in terms of planning families. However, what do we see and what do we assume with all adults that have an unplanned pregnancy that they intend to take to term? They rise to the occasion. They do the job, right? They try their best. The teens do the same thing. We have to, I think, as a community around these issues, we have to let go of our judgment and our shaming, and we have to approach these situations with respect. Respecting the teens, respecting that they're going to make their own decisions and helping them with information and content with regards to sexual health that is useful to them is what we need to provide them, not wagging a finger at them and telling them, no, you can't do whatever.
Denicia Cadena from Young Women United, I've heard your folks from your organization talk about this quite a bit, if parenting's hard at any age and more support needs to be offered to parents no matter what age they are. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Absolutely, Sarah. So as Johnny was saying, you know, teen parents have the same rates of unintended pregnancy of people any age. And at Young Women United, we work so that people of all ages have the information, access to resources that they need to make real decisions about their bodies and lives. And that's what's critical here. And when we think about the impact of stigma and shame, it's not only on the mental health of young parents, but it's also on their future opportunities that young parents start to believe that they can't succeed in school, that they won't have a future, and that has a huge impact on what they're able to achieve.
Mm. Let's go now to Sergio in Albuquerque. Sergio, I understand you're a young father. What can you share with us about your experience?
Hi, good morning. Correct. What I can share is that it has been difficult because of I've been hearing the show since this morning, correct, on Johnny and everyone else on there. Stigmas that get pointed out, you know, me and my girlfriend are currently young parents to a beautiful baby daughter of a year old. We do walk around the mall, and sometimes I do hear comments saying they ruined their lives, they don't know what's going on. And to me, that really brings us down because we're both at it really hard. I graduated in 2014 from Bernalillo High School, and my girlfriend recently graduated from Bernalillo High School as well. I currently have worked my position up to, I work at a bank at Wells Fargo, and she's currently going to Pima. So in my opinion, being a young parent, it is hard, but anything can be achieved. I mean, anything, literally work, school, there's nothing that's impossible. You just really have to put your mindset to it and always focus and remember that you're raising another person. It's not something easy, but it's something that can be done.
Yeah. Sergio, who's kind of helping you out, talking to you when you're feeling down, when you're feeling like, you know, you're having some of those struggles? Who's there to support you?
You know, I have a lot of people that support me, very, very lot of support. I actually attended the New Mexico grads in Berlin High School with Miss Rebecca Cost, as well as Johnny. I met Johnny a couple months ago. He has been a great support and help. You know, there's times that I've had, like we were talking about earlier, or you guys were talking about earlier, just the image of some parents thinking that the guy's going to leave. He's not going to stick with it. He's going to leave the girl being pregnant and not stick around to help out. I think that's an image that damages a lot of young men, because it's an image that's already out there, but not all of us do it. Some of us actually stick to it and being part of a family. I've struggled through that a lot. In-laws have been not a problem, but issues with them on showing me support that I can do it. And basically back to the question, Johnny has been one of my biggest supporters and has always helped me. My mom and my dad have always supported me to the 100. They have never let me down in any times of struggle. They try and coach me and show me a little bit. But the thing that I like from all the support that I have is that they help me make my own decisions. They don't tell me what to do, but kind of guide me and show me to what direction to turn to.
That was a clip from the KUNM Call-In Show last month, Supporting Teen Parents, hosted by Sarah Gustavus. You can find the full show on our podcast on iTunes or online at KUNM.org.
The law firm of Rothstein Donatelli is committed to supporting public radio KUNM. Since 1976, the firm has litigated civil rights, criminal defense, wrongful death, security clearance, and Indian and family law cases throughout New Mexico. RothsteinLaw.com.
Support comes from the Outpost Performance Space, presenting the jazz post-rock electronica of the Jacob Fred Jazz Odyssey, a film screening with Stephen Feld, and a publicity workshop with Tom Goralnik all this week. Details at outpostspace.org.
This is KUNM. I'm Elaine Baumgartel. It's about 11 minutes past 8 o'clock, and we're taking a look back at some of the best moments of the KUNM Call-In Show in recent months. Let's take a listen to a bit from another show. Marisa DeMarco, public health reporter at KUNM, hosted a discussion about breastfeeding on a show in August. She spoke with Aaron Marshall of the New Mexico Breastfeeding Task Force, Lissa Knudsen, advocate for breastfeeding support systems, and Jessica Ellis, creator of Nourish the Dream, a breastfeeding support community for Black mamas.
Now, we're going to talk about baby-friendly hospitals. And when I first heard this term, I was like, aren't all hospitals baby-friendly? What makes a hospital baby-friendly?
So that's a very specific designation. It's based on a global initiative out of the World Health Organization and UNICEF. And what it means is that a hospital is committed to a certain set of practices and optimal care in order to receive this designation from an organization called Baby Friendly USA, with which we are not affiliated. And they must adhere to the 10 steps. So there are specific practices that a hospital has to put in place. It takes a hospital typically 3 to 5 years to go on what we call the pathway to designation.
Jessica Ellis is the creator of Nourish the Dream Breastfeeding Support Community for Black Mamas. Thanks for joining us this morning, Jessica. What are you thinking about as we're talking about this hospital interaction?
Really, breastfeeding is the first thing that an infant learns. So the push and the rush for something, you know, that's really what breastfeeding is when it comes to the very, you know, after they come out, when it comes to the very first thing that mommy and baby do together. As a Black mama, I know I was blessed to have a good experience having a baby in the hospital, but I also had my team around me. You know, I brought my team into the hospital with me, and that is not available to lots of women of color, you know, to have support, to tell people, okay, you've been in my room enough, you know, to tell people, you know, no, give my body a chance to figure out what it's supposed to be doing.
Well, and let's talk about this. What are some of the other disparities for women of color when it comes to breastfeeding?
You know, it starts out knowing that our life matters from the conception. You know, through pregnancy, you struggle, there's barriers. You know what I'm saying? Then through birth, with interventions, there's barriers. And by the time you get to breastfeeding, it's like, what can I do right? It's, you know, so it has a lot to do with economical and support and culture. because in Black culture, it's about, you know, put your baby down so you can go take care of somebody else's baby. You know, and that's, we have the lowest breastfeeding rate because of the history. But at the same time, we were the most influenced about being wet nurses and feeding other people's babies. But now we can't even feed our own. You know, so besides being a Black single mama, I'm a Black single homeless mama. You know, because just the fact of it's a full-time job to grow a child. And for people to make it seem like, oh, it's just pumping some milk or it's not. You know what I'm saying? Our bodies grow human beings. Breastfeeding is about growing a human being. And I'm still growing a three-year-old, and sometimes that takes most of the day. You know.
So do you think that low-income households face different set of challenges, too?
I know. I don't think it. I know. This country knows it. You know, poverty is real. And it's really sad that we basically, as Black breastfeeding mamas, we have to go into poverty to be able to grow our child because there's no support from the state. There's no support from this country. And the welfare system somehow has forgot we're human beings. And they're not providing what we need to even sustain as a people, as a person. So it's the state of a Black parent is ugly, you know, and it's just about can we, as Black people, from the beginning of our children's lives, be able to tell them that their lives matter. You know what I'm saying? Black lives matter from the time that they come on this earth. And that means being able to nourish them and feed them, you know. So it's really about women knowing the power of their body, and no matter what the disparities are, that they can still nourish their kid. You know, because we'll be here all day talking about disparities, you know, but we could start with it'd be nice to be able to have a roof over your head while you're feeding your kid.
We have a call, too, from Kristen in Santa Fe. Kristen, good morning.
Good morning.
Hi. What are you thinking about this morning?
Well, I wanted to share my story. I did ask your crew if it would be wise, so I'm going to go ahead and say it anyway. So my son is now 11 years old. And he was born in the Taos Hospital. I had a very fortunate and unusual situation where I ended up in emergency C-section. And the gist of the whole thing is that I nursed my son while they were sewing me up.
Wow.
So skin-to-skin nursing is entirely possible, even in a C-section.
I just wanted to say that I think that's exactly how it's supposed to be. And I'm so proud of Taos Hospital for being able to understand that. You know, we've had a lot of barriers where sometimes, you know, trying to re-educate some of the providers that skin-to-skin matters. You know, they think of it as this, oh, it's sort of a choice that's sort of fluffy and it won't have that much significant difference, you know, make that much significant difference in the long run. But to recognize the power of that bond and of, you know, how important that's going to be to your health and to your child's health, and for them to make that a priority, that's amazing. They deserve a lot of credit for that.
Great. Thank you very much for sharing your story with us this morning, Kristen.
Sure.
Yeah.
You're welcome.
So one of the things that I really wanted to touch on, Jessica, is you've been an advocate for allowing new mothers who are behind bars to pump breast milk so it can be given to their babies. So let's talk a little bit about that. Why does that initiative matter?
Because 25% of incarcerated women are either pregnant or have had a baby within a year of being arrested. Women have sets at any time and place. And when you're picked up and arrested in a country where that can happen any time, especially if you're Black, you're always up to be arrested. They don't provide the contraception that's needed. You know, when you're taken away from your life out of nowhere, you lose your civil rights, and there's still human rights. And no matter what, the God-given right to be a mother shouldn't be up to the criminal justice system to take from you. You know what I'm saying? It's about the baby. You know, we can't... it's about babies getting human will that were made for them. My breast milk is made for my son. you know.
And women are actually the fastest growing prison population in New Mexico too. So it's the rate of the population that is being incarcerated more and more frequently as time goes on. So that's an increasing problem.
Yeah, I actually want to give a shout out to MDC here in Bernalillo County, because they're in the process of, they've drafted a policy to allow mothers that are separated from their babies due to incarceration to be able to maintain their milk supply, so that they're going to allow them to have pumps and have that milk then taken by some volunteers to their offsite child, so that their baby can still get that nourishment while they're separated.
And it was a law that was carried in the most recent legislative session, but I don't think it made it through, so that would be a statewide initiative.
That was Erin Marshall, Jessica Ellis, and Lissa Knudsen discussing efforts to support women who choose to breastfeed their children on the KUNM Call-In Show. Marisa DeMarco of KUNM's Public Health New Mexico Reporting Project hosted and produced that show. You can find it and other shows online at KUNM.org and all of our public health reporting online at publichealthnm.org.
And you are listening to KUNM on the second to last day of our fall fun drive. And we are having fun now. We have a lot more fun once we hear from you. All you have to do is decide what you are able to pledge, a little bit, a lot. Then call us up and pledge it, 277-4357 or toll free 866-899-5866. You know, if you get a little bit nervous when we talk about big money, big gifts, don't sweat it. That's only if you have a lot to give. For the rest of us, how about $5 a month? That's what I do. $5 a month transferred from me to KUNM every month. And honestly, I don't even notice it. So that's what I do. Maybe you could do that too. And if you do, well, we got a great thank you gift for you. When you contribute $60, which is $5 a month, you can get that great new KUNM tote bag. You can never have enough tote bags. You need as many as you can get. Keep them in your car. Keep them everywhere. Use them. It's real important to me that we get over this paper and plastic thing. Get some tote bags. You can get a great big KUNM tote bag by making a $60 pledge by calling us up at 277-4357 or toll free 866-899-5866. Seems like just a little bit of a lull right now, and so I am waiting for you. Hear me. Get up. Make that pledge. 277-4357.
Thanks to Leroy Goetz and Mary Teal of Albuquerque, Laura Migliacci of Albuquerque, Julie Newmark Engberg and Eric Engberg of Albuquerque. We also heard from George Coinis and Sherry Coinis. They are in Placitas renewing their membership. Thank you so much. Owen Kellum of Albuquerque, Tom Harmon and Sarah Keeney of Albuquerque, also Michelle Riedel and Cletus of Albuquerque renewing their memberships.
I love hearing the names of people I know. Hey, Tom and Leroy.
Thank you, everybody who has made a pledge already. We are welcoming brand new listeners. We are welcoming renewing listeners and members. Whether you are new or used, please call us up and make a pledge right now. 277-4357 or toll-free 866-899-5866. Thank you so much.
This is the hour when you are tuned in to listen to the KUNM Call-In Show. We've pulled some clips from some of our best recent shows to play for you today. Our next clip is from the show hosted by Gwyneth Doland earlier this year. She spoke with Christine Sierra, professor of political science at UNM, and former State Representative Janice Arnold-Jones about the charges that New Mexico Secretary of State Diana Duran is facing. She has been accused of using campaign money to gamble at casinos.
Let's quickly go to Jill in Albuquerque. Jill, what is your comment about this situation at the Secretary of State's office?
Well, I've lived in Albuquerque 23 years. I've never seen such a comedy of errors year after year. Transparency is just a word, and I don't think anybody adheres to it, even on the national level. And I care deeply, but we are the second worst educational system in the country behind Mississippi. So if you have a bunch of people who aren't educated and don't understand what voting means and who the candidates are and what the platforms and how important it is. I mean, we are reaping what we've sown. And Diana Duran is just one of the long line of inept, non-functional people that can't do their jobs. So, you know, where do you start to reform this? And that's all I have to say.
Jill, I hear you. That frustration is out there, and it is real. So thank you for expressing it. Professor?
Well, I just wanted to say that this is really a very unfortunate situation and very disappointing in a number of ways. I study elected officials across the country, and I look at especially the presence of women and women of color. And in this case, we have one individual who seems to have really fallen very far off a very important office, and it will draw national attention. For one thing, women and women of color still are very underrepresented in certainly in statewide office. I checked with the data from the Center for American Women in Politics. Overall, there are 14 secretaries of state, 7 Democrats and 7 Republicans. Only 2 are Hispanic women. One is Diana Duran. The other is Nelly Gorbea, a Democrat from Rhode Island. In terms of Latinas in statewide offices across the country, there are only 4. In addition to those 2 secretaries of state, it's Governor Martinez and a Lieutenant Governor Evelyn Sanguinetti, a Republican from Illinois. So when you have such small numbers in such important positions, the disappointment of seeing one person not be able to deliver in terms of competence and integrity and so on, it's quite disappointing and frustrating.
I'd like to jump in here because this is not really about professionalism in the ability to do the job. There were things that this office needed to do that Secretary Diana Duran has led the way, and it's gotten it done. And when I look at what happened under the previous administration, as you know, we were not able to purge or clean the voter rolls for years because the previous administration didn't do the job. It was a big deal. That was done. The charges in this case are really about a personal fall from grace. It appears to me that this truly is a gambling problem, and there were some personal choices, but it really didn't have anything to do with her ability to do the job in office.
We are joined today by Steve Terrell, political reporter and columnist for the Santa Fe New Mexican, Dr. Christine Sieta, an emeritus professor of political science at UNM, Janice Arnold-Jones, a former Republican state representative and transparency advocate, and joining us now on the phone is Walt Rubel, the regional opinion page editor at the Las Cruces Sun News. Welcome to the show.
Yeah, thank you.
Well, Diana Duran is from Tularosa. It's a village of about 300 people in southern New Mexico, not so far from Alamogordo and Las Cruces. You've been at the paper for a long time, and you've been following her since her days in the legislature 2 decades ago.
Right.
Before all of this news broke, how would you have described Diana Duran?
Honest and competent. And I know that sounds strange now, but this, for our editorial board, when she ran in this last election against Maggie Toulouse Oliver, was a very difficult choice for us because there were some things that Diana Duran had done in terms of voter fraud that we thought was a little bit of grandstanding. But we had no questions about her competency, and beyond that, we had no question about her honesty. And that had been a department or the Secretary of State before her had a lot of questions in that regard, and they were Democrats, and her being a Republican, I think she benefited by that. And so for me at least, and I've done this long enough to know that reporters don't ever really get to know the people who we're covering, and I think that's especially true with political reporters, but given that, this still came as a big surprise to me. You hear whisperings and you hear rumors about a lot of different people when you're working up in Santa Fe, and I just never heard any of that about her.
Me either. And, a couple of people I've talked to in the past 2 weeks who did know her better than reporters who kind of keep our distance,
right,
said they knew she liked to go to the casinos but just never would have imagined this. How are folks down there on her home turf reacting to this, Walt?
I think the same as everybody else. I think there is some anger just because of what you guys have been talking about. Here we go again. You know, here's another one. But beyond that, I think there's some sadness because I think people down here like Diana Duran. They know her, and they, you know, I think people, a lot of people, are still waiting to hear an explanation, and are hoping that, you know, even against the evidence, that, you know, maybe there is a reason for this. But you know, so far that hasn't come.
That was Christine Sierra and Janice Arnold-Jones, along with Walt Rubel, the regional opinion page editor at the Las Cruces Sun News, talking with host Gwyneth Doland about the charges faced by Secretary of State Diana Duran. That show was produced earlier this year. You can find it online at KUNM.org.
Edible Arrangements at 4770 Montgomery Boulevard Northeast in Albuquerque offers fresh fruit bouquets and chocolate-dipped fruit for any occasion. EdibleArrangements.com or 505-888-0100. Edible Arrangements is a valued supporter of KUNM.
Support comes from Animal Humane's Doggy Dash and Dottle, Sunday, November 1st at Balloon Fiesta Park. Dasher, Dottle, and races, play in the Doggy Carnival, discover treats at Barkett Place, and more. Register at doggy-and-dottle.org.
Let's take a listen to a bit from another KUNM call-in show. Ed Williams, public health reporter at KUNM, hosted a discussion about the cost of rent in Albuquerque. It's unusually high given our economy. He spoke with Felipe Real of the Greater Albuquerque Housing Partnership.
Let's go to the phone lines. Norm is with us from Albuquerque. Hi, Norm. Welcome.
Hi.
Go right ahead.
In my experience, in over 15 years of renting in various apartment complexes in Albuquerque, I seem to think that the problem is a lot of complexes have been sold and resold, and I think it's partially greed. Many complexes that I've lived in the last few years have started doing things to nickel and dime us besides our normal rent. For example, we now have to pay for the batteries in our smoke detectors. We have to pay for air filters on our air conditioning system. We have to pay for keys to get into the pool, and we have to have a tag also to get into the pool. And if we lose those, then those tags and those keys cost $50 each. To me, it's a money-making process for these apartment complexes, and I'm not sure what their intention is other than just to make money. A lot of the amenities that are shown to you when you move into an apartment complex, like pools and
right.
office equipment.
Norm, I hear what you're saying. Do you still live in an apartment today?
Or they don't use them, okay? I'm sorry, go ahead.
Are you still living in an apartment today?
Yes.
How are these costs affecting, you know, your quality of life? Are you having trouble? Is this eating into other parts of your budget?
Yes. My rent just recently was raised $35 per month. That's the highest I've ever been raised in my 15 years. The trash cost that they affixed to us, the water cost, these are costs that are passed not from the city to the tenant, but the apartment complex, the owners, they get the bill and they add on a commission or a profit, and then they pass it on to us, and those keep increasing.
Well, I think you bring up a good point, Norman, and I'm not sure if it's motivated by greed. I know the apartment owners also have a bottom line that they have to attend to, and if I'm understanding it right, Felipe, the costs are increasing for people that are running apartments. Is that right?
Sure. I mean, they're not... I mean, the $35, Norm, I understand that's impacting your household acutely. I get that. I understand that. What I'm just trying to explain is the situation there. Their costs are probably increasing more than that. So what they're doing with these things like the RUBS, Resident Utility Billback Program, and adding on their premium on top of that is trying to just cover their overhead expenses and keep the lights on and keep the property nice to attract new tenants. It's just a catch-22 for everything. That landlord would actually like to increase it more, but to predicate that, you would need to be making a lot more money, and we're just not seeing that overall in the economy. I doubt your income. I'm not going to ask you specifically, Norm, but I doubt your income has been increasing dramatically enough to be able to absorb all these costs. And that's where we're hitting the acute problem overall in our marketplace. Yours is a one specific example. I think we could expand that across kind of all the renter population in Albuquerque. And it's just unfortunate.
Well, let's go to one more call. Alex is on the phone with us from Albuquerque. Hi, Alex. Welcome.
Hi. Well, thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. Thanks for calling.
I was actually just calling because, you know, we were doing okay with our rent here in Albuquerque, but then I got pregnant and my husband and I, you know, I had to stop working. And then all of a sudden we realized how hard the cost of rent was on a family when you have a new baby and you're not able to go back to work. And I had a hard time going back to work because my son wouldn't take a bottle and it was a whole feeding issue that he just fed a lot. And I had realized that it was just a lot better for me to try and figure out how for me to stay home. But then we started realizing how much of our rent was our income. And even though, you know, we're in a small two-bedroom apartment, we had a really hard time finding two bedrooms under $700 a month or so. And we found one that worked for us. And then after the cost of utilities and renter's insurance and stuff, it's about $800 or so, $820 for us. And it's about 39% of our income now that we're on one income. And it's been really hard. And it makes, you know, staying home with a new baby really difficult. And so I've just recently starting to go back to work now and in order to afford income. But now that my son is older, a little older, he's a toddler now, it's not as expensive with childcare.
Well, Alex, thanks for sharing that. You know, that's probably something that you're not alone in Albuquerque. Guys, is there any help for people like Alex who, you know, who are struggling with paying rent with a new family? I mean, what do you do in that situation?
Sure, I can speak. We are with the Greater Albuquerque Housing Partnership, and we're an affordable housing developer. And what we utilize is some federal and some state resources in our own capital and City of Albuquerque capital. And we provide housing that is affordable for the person that comes in. So the idea is if you're in a certain income band, and once again, we're going to get into the statistics and get bogged down the money. But if you're at a certain income band, the idea is that you're paying no more than 30% of your income, including utilities, to live at our complex. And so we have a couple different complexes across town, and there's many others, folks like us. There's Yes Housing. There's the Sawmill Community Land Trust. There's also some private developers that do the same type of aspect. But the idea is that those folks that live in our complexes do not pay more than 30% of your rent. The problem is there's just not enough of those units around. We're typically running at 97.5% to 100% occupied with a waiting list. So I think that just proves that there's just a big demand out there for this type of product, but just not enough supply.
That was a clip from the KUNM Call-In Show this past summer. Why do we spend so much on rent in New Mexico? Hosted and produced by Public Health New Mexico's Ed Williams. He spoke with Felipe Rael and callers. Find all of our public health reporting online at publichealthnm.org. Right now it's about 8:37. I'm Elaine Baumgartel. It's our fall membership campaign, and Mary B's in the studio with me. What's the update, Mary B?
Well, the update is we are almost out of time this morning, and we need to make a little more money before we get to 9 o'clock this morning, and you could really help us do that by calling us at 277-4357, 277-4357, or toll free 866-899-5866. Our fall fund drive is almost over. Tomorrow is the very last day. You've been listening all week. You've been thinking, I got to pledge, but you haven't pledged yet. Well, we are almost out of time.
Now's the time.
Yes. So come on, get over that procrastination. Stop, think, call 277-4357. Just like Tammy Abbott's from, this is a business
Thanks,
pledge.
Thanks, Tammy.
A good sign. She's got a business called A Good Sign.
It's an awesome.
I bet they've got a lot of good signs
sign
at A Good
company.
Sign.
Super
yeah,
cool.
Cool. Thank you for that. If you are a business owner, make your pledge in the name of your business, but do it right now, okay? Please.
277-4357. I'm so eager to give you the number.
You
Sorry,
got it.
Mary. 277-4357 is the number to call. That's locally here in Albuquerque. You can also call toll-free 866-899-5866. Perhaps you tune in every Thursday morning for the KUNM call-in show to hear these kinds of conversations and to be able to weigh in on the conversations. That's the beauty of a live call-in show. Folks like Charles and Lori Stonecipher of Santa Fe and Jerry Stamen of Albuquerque, they contributed this year in support of the KUNM call-in show. They like other shows too, but they specifically wanted to say, hey, we support the KUNM call-in show. If you tune in every week for this valuable public service that we provide, please call now and support the programming. 277-4357 is the number to call. You can also go online to KUNM.org. You can pledge online by using our online contribution form. You'll be able to check out the gifts that we have, etc., etc. But do it now. 277-4357.
We are waiting for you, you, you. Seriously, the time is right now. We've got this whole fundraiser thing cranked up just for you, so you can make your gift quickly and easily. It's going to be gone in a flash. It'll be a darn shame if you miss the boat. So come on, make that pledge right now. 277-4357 or toll free 866-899-5866. This is how we pay for public radio. You're a listener. Please be a listener supporter. 277-4357, 866-899-5866.
So our Public Health New Mexico reporters have done quite a bit of coverage of the legacy of uranium and the nuclear power and nuclear weapons industries in New Mexico. On the KUNM call-in show in June, Ed Williams spoke with Edith Hoodie and Bertha Nez, residents of the Red Pond Road community on the Navajo Nation, and Jordan Johnson of McKinley Community Place Matters about the legacy of abandoned uranium mines on the Navajo Nation.
Right. Well, cancer is a hard thing to prove, I guess, causality. But Jill, the caller, has a friend that has lung cancer from mining. Edith, you yourself have had a cancer issue because, or at least, you know, you were also a miner. I guess you can't point exactly to it. How many people do you guys know out on the reservation that have been living in proximity to mines that have experienced cancer or other health problems?
There are several that has gone, that live near the mine. So there's a few that are there and right down the Rio Porco, Arroyo. People down all the way up to Gallup, they have some the people that pass away with cancer.
Right. Why is it so hard to draw that connection when it seems so obvious? You know, we're not doctors here, but if we know uranium can cause cancer and people around the uranium sites are getting cancer, why can't we prove that?
That's a great question, Ed. I mean, it would be really nice if we, again, can conduct more studies to make that really scientific case. And there just has not been a significant amount of studies done specifically around cancers to make that case. And there are some studies around kidney that some folks from the Southwest Information Center and UNM are conducting. Yet cancer is a little bit more difficult. And we have heard stories of people who have lost generations due to cancer rates or respiratory problems. So tell
us a little bit more about the studies that have taken place before your study. I mean, have people looked at this issue? Mr. Clancy from the EPA was saying it's a low-level radiation, so, you know, just walking through the area wouldn't cause problems necessarily. But has it raised the attention of a lot of medical researchers before your study?
From my research at this point, I would say that there isn't enough studies being done for the people on the Navajo Nation, from my perspective. And I think it's hard, too, because one of the things we often forget is people who are victims of these kind of disasters are often marginalized already and experiencing high rates of poverty or just living to survive. And so when you compound that with health and stress and trying to decide whether you're going to move or not move, those are all also increases people's potential for different kind of health outcomes.
Right. We have a large population in this state that suffers from issues of poverty and health, but some of those have at least gotten state funding for for studies, and I guess that hasn't happened here.
No, and there are conversations around trying to get a health study from a state perspective around a health profile in the Grants Mineral Belt, which would be a big first step to moving the conversation forward, to kind of figuring out the baseline so then we can conduct more studies to kind of put the direct connection between the different kind of diseases or stress levels or the cultural relevance of the land to people. And so then we can start to make the cases that we need to make.
Edith, Bertha, let's talk a little bit more about the cultural relevance of the land for you. And I know that a lot of people that have had to move from your community really want to move back and move back permanently. Why is it so important to you to live there when you know that there can be environmental problems that have happened in the past?
I was born there, and I wanted to stay there. And that's our playground, and that's where we live. And we want our kids to, and that to be there, for our kids to be, and the grandkids, and to live there. And so that's, we just want to hold on to the land that our elderlies had put us there.
What does it mean spiritually when this kind of pollution happens for the Navajo people? When the land is polluted like it was, I mean, does that have a spiritual significance, just the fact that the land has been spoiled?
Well, with all the prayers the elderlies had done and the cultural sacredness there, it's kind of like when they remove all those dirt and stuff, they took those, kind of like erasing that whatever was done there. Okay. So we want, we rather have that not disturbed, because that's the way it used to be. Cause we, and then we have the plants there and the water, so that's all been ruined.
Edith, you wanted to say something?
Okay. Culturally, you know, as parents, they have young ones that are born, and from there they take their umbilical cords and they bury them there where we live. And of course we have people that have passed on that used to be, that are buried there already. And of course, like she said, we have plants and all these that we use in our spiritual rites, cultural rites. They're all there. And when they go to bury the umbilical cord in the ground, they say a prayer that will always bring the child back to where she's from. That's the philosophy behind this.
What would you say is the most important thing that you want our listeners to understand about your experience? What should they take away from this?
That the human life is priceless, and we don't want this uranium being brought back up from the earth again, because these mining companies are ready to come back in, and we don't want that. And to keep this Navajo Nation ban in place to keep the miners away from the reservation. And to be more educated about how these uranium has affected the lives of the human beings that maybe have worked there or even lived there.
That was Edith Hoodie and Bertha Nez, along with Jordan Johnson, discussing the legacy of uranium mining on the Navajo Nation. The show was hosted and produced by Ed Williams of KUNM's Public Health New Mexico Project. You can find the full show on our podcast on iTunes and other shows online at KUNM.org, and all of our public health reporting online at publichealthnm.org. Let's take a listen to one more segment from a KUNM call-in show. This one was hosted by Gwyneth Dolan, who spoke with Tommy Roberts. He's the mayor of Farmington, and they talked about the impact of the Gold King Mine waste spill.
Welcome back to the KUNM Call-In Show. We are talking about the impact of the Gold King mine waste spill on the folks downstream in Durango, in Farmington, and moving on out to the Navajo Nation. Mayor, do you think that all of this water trucking has stretched the resources of folks in San Juan County and around there to, you know, do they have enough trucks and barrels to get this water around?
Oh, I haven't heard of any real issues in that regard. I know that until just recently, and maybe yesterday or the day before, this water that was being trucked to the reservation was coming from the city of Bloomfield supply. And their supply comes off the San Juan River above the confluence of the San Juan and the Animas.
So it was good water, but maybe in trucks that had been previously used for something else.
I think that's what you have to surmise, that the trucking company providing the water from the city of Bloomfield is an oil field service company. There may have been some remnants of the contents of those tanks that were mixed with the water. We just don't know, and I've only heard these anecdotal stories about the quality of that water. But I think that what was supposed to happen was that this non-potable water was to be delivered for use for agricultural purposes, for irrigation purposes.
Mayor, you will probably be putting in some claims for the costs to the city. What has this spill cost Farmington, if not in exact numbers? You know, what have you had to do because of it?
Well, we've expended a tremendous amount of manpower to monitor the event and to assist in our countywide implementation of our emergency operations plan. Many people working overtime hours. I've been very impressed with the way our people have responded. We haven't begun to really sit down to quantify all the resources that we've infused into this process.
We want to go to Travis in Albuquerque, who has a comment about farming. Travis, what does this bring up for you?
Hi, good morning. Thank you for having me on the show. I farm in Atrisco in Albuquerque, New Mexico. And yeah, we just want to say that we're in solidarity. We had a prayer by the river with a bunch of groups from University of New Mexico on Friday. Just praying for the families, the communities, the land, basically all of creation that's affected by the spill. And one thing we wanted to say was, I hope this spill, to use a mining metaphor, is the canary in the room that we can learn from and realize that we're not living harmoniously on the earth, and that more care has to be taken to protect our water, to protect our land.
You bring up a really good point. I think Travis was pointing to that, the canary in the coal mine, and the connection being that this plume of yellow water was a signal that all is not well up there in the river. Let's talk to Russell in Albuquerque, who has a question about the continuing leakage. Russell, welcome to the show.
Good morning. The EPA has been monitoring leakage from this mine for years. In 2011, it measured it at 176 gallons per minute, which is why the EPA was up there trying to stop it. 176 gallons per minute is 3 million gallons every 12 days. So this particular spill is only an additional 12 days worth. You know, as bad as it is, that's still only 3% of how much leaks out in a year.
Russell, that's a great point. I want to go back to you, Mayor Roberts, up there in Farmington. You know, we were talking earlier in the hour about how folks have been talking for a long time about making this area in Colorado a Superfund site, which would open up a lot of money, but also has some drawbacks. Would you support establishing a Superfund designation for some of these old mines?
I wouldn't be able to make that call without a lot more information and data to research and to analyze. I think that that's a discussion that we will have to have, but I think an argument can be made, just as the gentleman has just made it, that there has been historical leakage from this mine, and without the alarm associated with what we saw with this recent 3 million gallon leakage, the argument probably could be made that designating Superfund monies to clean up these sites might not be the best use of money.
I reserve judgment on that. I think we need a lot more information to determine what benefits could be derived from the expenditure of that that sum of money.
That was Tommy Roberts, mayor of Farmington, discussing the Gold King Mine waste spill. Gwyneth Dolan hosted and produced that episode of the KUNM Call-In Show. Thanks to Anna Landy, KUNM News intern, for her work producing those segments from recent KUNM Call-In Shows. She's a UNM student. She's sitting right next to me, and we're delighted to have her working with us. Find all these shows online at KUNM.org or sign up for the KUNM Call-In Show podcast on iTunes. This programming would not be possible without your help.